This is Kendra Brodine, founder and CEO of WomenLawyersOnline.com. And today I am thrilled to bring you a conversation with Barry Goldstein. Barry has practiced law for more than 35 years, much of that time litigating in federal and state trial courts in New York and Connecticut. She started her career as one of only a handful of women practicing in the civil division of the United States Department of Justice in 1974. Barry now has her own practice, Barry L. Goldstein, LLC, which she opened in Litchfield County in 2008 with a special focus on family law, including divorce, custody, child support, and child protection, in addition to her expertise in civil litigation. Barry began her career through the Justice Department's Honors Program in 1974. She represented the United States government in major cases, including the defense of President Ford's imposition of a licensing fee on imported oil and the defense as to the constitutionality of the National Flood Insurance Act. After a brief stint in the private sector, Barry joined the New York Attorney's General Office, where she served as Special Litigation Counsel for 13 years. Her work was diverse and consisted of unique and complicated cases. Barry, together with outside counsel, represented the state in a complex bankruptcy proceeding. She handled civil rights challenges brought under the Constitution's Due Process Clause and defended state officials in many different contexts, including the redevelopment of Times Square and the refusal to allow a New Jersey dealer to sell milk in New York. Barry was appointed the Director of Special Litigation for the Juvenile Rights Division of the New York City's Legal Aid Society in 2001. She served as lead counsel in the landmark case of Nicholson versus Williams, where foster care children challenged their removal by the city's child protection agency solely on the ground that their mothers were victims of domestic violence. The gravamen of their complaint rested on the city's failure to balance the harm caused by the removal with the danger of remaining in the home. The court ruled in favor of the children, and this case is widely cited around the country for establishing best practices. Barry has taken on a diverse range of cases since opening her own office in Litchfield County, Connecticut. She is litigating a land use case in federal court in which the plaintiff challenges a town's refusal to allow the construction of a gate on the ground that the denial violates the plaintiff's procedural and substantive due process rights under the United States Constitution. She has handled complex child custody cases involving the relocation of children from Florida and North Carolina. And in the area of child protection, Barry has represented parents in proceedings involving the removal of their children on grounds of purported neglect and sexual abuse. Barry has continued to serve the public interest. In recognition of her mastery of complex litigation, the family court has appointed her guardian ad litem in some of the most difficult cases to come to the court. Barry also acts as a consultant to the Susan B. Anthony Project, which offers services to victims of domestic violence. Barry, I'm so delighted to have you on the call today.
I am so happy to be with you.
Thank you. Well, why don't we just jump right in to the questions, because hopefully we will get to hear a little bit more about the diverse and deep background that you have in the practice of law as we look back, and then we can also glean from your experience of what you've experienced in terms of both personal and professional as you've gone along. Does that sound all right?
That's terrific.
Great. Barry, I'm wondering, as you look back and you think about your life and your educational career, your professional career, would you say that you've always been good at balancing the personal and the professional, your work and your life, or your education and the rest of your life? Or do you think that it was something that changed at some pivotal point or critical juncture in your life?
You know, I think I would have to answer that question in three different segments. The first, going all the way back, really when I was in high school, and that's in the 60s, women did not become lawyers. I mean, there were some from an earlier generation, but certainly there were not a lot of women. And where I grew up, it was generally expected that a girl would marry a lawyer or marry a doctor. So when I announced, I guess I was in eighth grade, that I wanted to be a lawyer, it kind of set me apart from the very beginning. And it really was not a question of balancing my professional and personal desires. I had to choose a path, and There were many who did not agree with my choice. I was engaged to a really great guy. And we had to choose who would go to law school. We couldn't afford both to go to law school. And while I had done very much better than he in terms of academics and had gotten into better law schools, he expected that I would support him through law school as a secretary.
Oh, wow.
And I said no. I broke the engagement. So I guess you would say there was no balance there. I chose the professional. And similarly, there was a second period of my life where there were very few women at the Justice Department. You know, I can remember a time where the then Attorney General, Edward Leavy, had the women up for lunch in his conference room. There were about 10 of us. That was it in the entire Justice Department. And, you know, that was a different period, too. Women such as myself had to prove themselves. And that meant working pretty hard, probably harder than the men did. I mean, we had to prove things. And I often had to travel around the country because of the nature of my practice. Well, that was an experience because judges in Missouri had never met a female lawyer. And I can remember the first time I stood up in court and the judge, who was really trying to be nice, said, well, it's so very nice to have a pretty woman lawyer here.
Oh, my goodness.
And I didn't quite know what to do because, of course, it was sexist to the fare-thee-well. But on the other hand, I had a duty to represent a client, and I didn't want to tick off the judge. So I said, thank you. And there was a, you know, these are battle stories. There was another time where I was in Mobile, Alabama, again with a great judge who really was fond of me. And I had a trial on Memorial Day, because he didn't believe in, he thought Memorial Day was a Yankee holiday. And, the trial, took place, the courtroom was open, but there was no air conditioning. And in the middle of the afternoon, when I was examining the most important witness in the case, he turned to me and he said, Ms. Goldstein, you may pull off your blouse if you want. What to do?
Oh my God.
I turned to my co-counsel, who was my boss. This was one of my first experiences. And his eyebrows were arched. And he was saying to me, up to you. And I turned back and I said, well, Your Honor, I don't think I can do that, but I would ask that the gentlemen in the courtroom be permitted to take off their jackets. So that was a stage where my professional aspirations certainly took precedence to my personal aspirations, which is not to say that I didn't do a great deal of dating. When I was traveling, the U.S. Attorney's Office was responsible for introducing me to court, and I met a lot of U.S. attorneys in the process, but certainly my career and developing my legal skills was most important to me. And then there came a time, that third stage, where I became more mature and wanted to have a family and develop more balance in my life. And while I was not able to have a family for complicated medical reasons, I did find a wonderful man who has been my husband for the last 20 years. And we have integrated my professional and personal life because he helps me. I run things by him all the time. And in addition, he understands when I have to work on Christmas because I've got a client who's got a serious problem with an ex-husband. So I think that I have developed more of a balance and definitely want to continue with that.
Those are some amazing, as you said, war stories. That shocking. I mean, I almost blush on your behalf as I hear them. Just, I can't even imagine. And in the moment, trying to think of the correct thing to say, something that was completely out of line. Amazing. Just amazing.
Well, I mean, there is a generation that followed me, and then there were civil rights statutes, harassment statutes that were enacted. I mean, I once had a terrible harassment situation, and it was before the Civil Rights Act in 1976 had been declared to cover sexual harassment. And so if you can't imagine my experiences, it's because this was a different generation.
It's so true. And thankfully, because, again, for women that have come after you, including myself, we owe women like you a debt of gratitude for navigating through that very tricky water and challenging water of being sort of the first or being in that leading group of women who are out there paving the way, teaching judges, teaching opposing counsel how to be with women in the courtroom, how to interact with women as attorneys and respect them as professionals. And like you said, the fact that I can't imagine that happening is a good sign that things have changed, but shocking that it wasn't that long ago that it was happening.
Well, that's true. And one of the secrets, I think, for women has been becoming more comfortable in their own skin. I had a mentor who was 6'2" and had steely gray hair. And he had this baritone voice and would really make his presence known in court through those features. Well, I'm 5 foot, and I don't have that kind of voice. And so it's important, I think, women have found a way to make their presence known through their own personage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that comfort in your own skin, as you said, just being able to be who you are and comfortable with that makes such a difference.
That's true. I mean, at this stage of my career, I hesitate to say what stage it is. I feel pretty comfortable being able to master whatever is put in front of me. Like, I would not suggest that I can master antitrust law or patent law or, you know, any of those very esoteric things. But I feel comfortable that I'm going to be able to master it and then be able to present myself in court. Mm-hmm. And that's just because I have all of this experience.
And that must be comforting, just to have that confidence in your skill set that you know you can do it. You know you can do a good job at it. And like you said, you certainly know maybe when it would be a bit of a stretch if it was incredibly specialized. But generally, you feel like if something was thrown at you, you could take care of it and do a good job for your clients. And that must give you great peace of mind, especially in your new practice in a small town where I'm guessing it's not as specialized. Folks want to come to you with all sorts of things.
Well, that's right. And I mean, what I promise a client is that if I don't know, well, first of all, I say that. I mean, I won't ever mislead a client. But if I don't know, I have many colleagues all over who I can pick up the phone and say, okay, what about this situation? Mm-hmm. And I have done that in any number of different instances since I opened my practice.
It is great, as you mentioned, having a mentor, but to also have those contacts and that network, and you have such a depth of experience with incredible attorneys, certainly in the New York area, and I'm sure around the country at this point, to draw from and to make that ask, to make yourself a little bit vulnerable and say, I've encountered this question, and I don't quite know all the answers. Could you lend me your advice for a little bit? And I'm sure people are willing to help out, but to have those people to go to is such a blessing.
Yeah, when I was with the Attorney General's office, I had one matter where my adversary was a very well-known lawyer in New York, and he introduced me to the Federal Bar Council, which is probably the premier association for federal lawyers, and it's the association where the judges of the Second Circuit and the District Court in New York turn for, opinion. And through there, I just developed the most amazing contacts, but more importantly, friends. I mean, I've made any number of friends, and that's wonderful.
those networking opportunities that we think of that we think sometimes they would only serve us professionally or when we get involved in our bar associations or other organizations related to the law, we think about it sometimes in more of a marketing, networking, business way. But there are such fantastic people out there that we might not encounter otherwise and that are sharing this journey of being an attorney. And it's just so delightful to meet them sometimes. And like you said, form relationships outside of the professional that become deep personal relationships.
That's right.
There's good people out there, and we don't have to always think of each other just as opposing counsel.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, well, when I grew up, my dad used to say, people are people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so very true. I mean, it's kind of even trite. But encountering these leading members of the bar, I mean, the members, I mean, who have handled, like, the major cases that you can think of, and the judges who participate in the bar activities, they're people. I mean, I've met Sonia Sotomayor at a bar function, mm-hmm. and she's a lovely person. She's not, I mean, she's a judge, and she was a judge then, but she's a person.
I think it's true, and like you said, it may sound trite, people are people, but it's sage wisdom that generally people are people, and we roll out of bed in the morning and we put on our pants one leg at a time, and we're just, everybody's a person, and for the most part, they're really neat people to get to know and enjoyable, and it's so delightful, great, terrific when we run into people, like you said, who have incredible backgrounds, have done amazing things professionally and with their law degree and in their firms or in the government or all sorts of other things, and yet they're so approachable and willing to share and willing to have the conversation or the drink or the give the advice. And I don't know what it is, if it's just fear of folks who have more notoriety or we expect that we'll be more aloof, but when we can actually just introduce ourselves and make the acquaintance, it's amazing the kind of people that are willing to share of themselves personally as well as professionally.
Well, that's true. I developed a friendship with a woman who is a wonderful success story for women, older than I am, and also a mentor. And she really was always looking out for my interest and would put me on this committee and that committee, and I kept on meeting people. And she, you know, she's really was one of the influences in my life.
And I think women especially, I'm sure men are too, and so I don't mean to overgeneralize, but women are excited to see other women succeed so many times. And sometimes we assume the opposite and we get competitive with other women, but when we can come together and support one another and be of help to one another, I think women are so willing to give of themselves and to offer that advice or that support or whatever it looks like. And mentorship, so key for new lawyers or women who are growing their practice or growing themselves somehow, to have someone to look to and to ask the hard questions.
Yeah, you're so right. And one of the best parts of my job at the Attorney General office was to supervise the summer intern program.
Mm-hmm.
I would interview the law students, you know, during the winter, and then bring on a class of, oh, I don't know, anywhere between 20 and 25 students, and there were a fair number of women, and it was the best part was to supervise them and to, you know, give them constructive advice and hear some parts of what was going on in their life and see if I could steer them in the right direction. And here's a funny story. My husband and I were having dinner at a really lovely restaurant in New York, and I was kind of babbling on about one of my cases. And the table next to us, there was a young woman, and turned out to be her uncle. And she said, "Excuse me, I are you at the Attorney General's office?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Oh, I'm so interested in that. I'm an undergraduate, and I just really want to go to law school." So I said, "Well, bring me your resume and come in tomorrow. I'll interview you." And she did. And she went from there to the Legal Aid Society, where I had by that point gone, and she was a law student at that point. Finally graduated from law school, became a member of the bar, practiced in California for a few years, and then about a month and a half ago, it turned out that she was my adversary at a deposition.
Oh, wow.
It was terrific.
That's neat.
Right. And after the deposition, we went out for lunch.
I'm sure. Beautiful. Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. How it comes full circle. And for you, I'm sure to see her out there doing the work and know that you are a part of that, I mean, how gratifying. Even when it's opposing counsel, you know, that's just our job, is to have that. It doesn't have to be personally adversarial when it's professionally adversarial. And
right.
How gratifying.
It truly was. And she was there with a senior lawyer as well, and the senior lawyer was more of my contemporary, and we were both smiling. We were very, very pleased to see her shine like
wonderful.
That.
Barry, I'm wondering, as you look back over this long and great career, deep career with lots of different experiences and terrific stories. I'm loving your stories of in the trenches. I'm wondering if you would say that there's been one big challenge or struggle, kind of overarching in that way, that you've faced in terms of trying to find that balance, be it when you know you were making hard decisions, like you mentioned, having to break off an engagement or trying to navigate a maybe unfriendly court system in the earlier parts of your career, or maybe later now with your marriage and finding that alignment between who you are personally and professionally. Is there one great struggle or big challenge that you would name as maybe being the toughest thing that you came up against?
I would say it's time. My husband's in commercial real estate, and he does deals. So there are periods where he's off, and I mean, he's just waiting for someone to get back to him. I, on the other hand, bill by the hour, and it's very difficult to find the balance between when I'm going to work on Christmas and when I'm not going to work on Christmas, or when we're going to plan a holiday and when I'm very uncertain about a trial being scheduled. I mean, that's a continuing problem, but as I've gotten older, I've become more, as I said earlier, more comfortable in my own skin, so I feel that I know exactly when I have to really work. And I'm not sure that is a complete answer to your question, but the struggle never leaves you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always there, and, you know, this is very funny. I never know who I am. I mean, my maiden name is Goldstein. My professional name is Goldstein, but I have a married name, mm-hmm. and sometimes I'm Barry Goldstein, and sometimes I'm Barry Ebersman, my married name.
Ah, sure.
It's very confusing. Everyone actually knows me as Barry Ebersman because I've been in the community a long time. But it's, you know, that's a challenge of, you know, who you are. And also, I mean, many of our friends, social friends up here, the women don't have professions. And, you know, here I do. And so it's there can be some awkwardness in you know, the gatherings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure in a smaller town setting that you've moved to, that it's very different than the kind of social circle or just general societal way of doing things that you were encountering when you were in the city.
That's very true. But on the other hand, the women in the community, my contemporaries, have formed an organization which is just social. And we meet once a month, and it's, you know, there is a fair degree of networking, but it's mm-hmm. not the most important part of getting together. And I find that I am, you know, clearly respected and looked to for advice, and something that I'm more than happy to do. And I also do a lot of pro bono work up here.
And what a great way to both serve the community and let people know about you and your work. And I love also the fact that you have that social outlet with women in the community just to come together. And in this day and age when we become so fragmented, even in a smaller community, with the internet and social media and email and phones, and we never get out and see people and get to know them. And, you know, I live in the suburbs, and it's always embarrassing to me when I find out that somebody lives a block away from me, and I don't know them. I didn't know they lived there. I didn't know they were in my neighborhood.
Right.
And it's just sort of it's a sad thing in the suburbs when you pull into your garage and your garage is attached and you walk in your house and you shut the door, and sometimes you don't get to encounter even your own neighbors. So I think that kind of organization is such an important part of getting not only known in the community, but also finding others in the community that you can relate to and hang out with and enjoy.
Yeah, that's very true. And actually, I didn't have that in New York. I mean, I had women colleagues at the office, but they went their separate way. I mean, I had some, when I was at the Attorney General's office, I mean, I think this is something that's interesting. Women went to the Attorney General's office in the 60s and the 70s because they were not welcome at law firms. And you had some just consummate lawyers, actually lawyers who ended up arguing in the Supreme Court. But I wasn't married at that point, and we did befriend each other, and that was a group. And there again, I was a protege. I was the younger one. So that was a very, very good experience for me. And up here, there's a domestic violence project, and I'm participating in that and getting to know people through that. And, of course, living in a small town means that people know you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Know you sometimes more than you even want them to know you.
Right.
Barry, what would you say then, as you talked about the challenges and not having enough time, which is always, I mean, such a big challenge in the way you described it, are there ways that, or things that you would say you've learned along the way, and maybe particularly the biggest lesson that you've learned? I'm wondering if there's been an overarching way of thinking or philosophy or way of doing things that's been very meaningful to you and has been a lesson to you as you've tried to integrate yourself professionally and personally.
Well, I would say, this is kind of a theme, is feeling comfortable in your own skin and feeling confident that you should do what you believe is right. I don't do things for the result. I do things because of who I am, both personally and as a lawyer. I mean, for example, I have a client coming in after we speak who is in the midst of a child custody battle and is not receiving child support, and she is broke. Sometimes she runs out of gas in her car, and she doesn't have a computer. So I'm loaning her a computer and a printer, a laptop and a printer. And, you know, I'm doing that because that's who I am. On the other hand, and this is kind of interesting, I drafted a lease agreement so that this was a professional type of undertaking. And that, I'm not sure I would have done both of those things earlier in my career, but I appreciate the significance of not only being a professional, but being, you know, a good person. When I was younger, I think I was a little rigid in my professionalism. I used to wear, this goes way back, a suit with a bow tie. I mean, I don't know if anyone else will remember that, but that's what women lawyers wore. And, I mean, we were stiff. I'm not stiff anymore.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that's maybe part of the evolution as well of what was expected?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
No question about that. I mean, and wearing very, you know, dark clothes so you don't call attention to yourself in court. Now, I will say that I have been shocked to see how some women lawyers now dress. I was in the Second Circuit. This was a number of years ago at this point. And I was arguing against an assisting United States attorney. Now, the Second Circuit is an august court. I mean, it's a very significant court in our system. And she came in with sandals and dirty toenails.
Oh, wow.
I don't think that's right. But, and up here, the dress is much more informal.
Mm-hmm.
So, but back in my days at the Justice Department and in the early days of the Attorney General's office, I mean, you were buttoned up.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like, and maybe.
And loose clothes. Very loose clothes.
The pendulum has swung maybe too far the other way.
Maybe too much. We could do some dress for success tips.
I think so. I there's certainly a level of professionalism, just as you would expect with a man. I mean, certainly women have, I think, the advantage, at least personally, of being able to express ourselves a little bit more through what we wear and how we wear it. And I'm glad that we don't have to dress as much like a man as we could, which I'm sure was more of the experiences you had starting out, you know, to become, you know, dress in the black suit with a white shirt and a bow tie or whatever it took, except definitely a skirt, I would guess, not pants.
Definitely not pants. I would never wear pants to court.
Not pants. But to have, but somehow to nowadays remain very professional, but express ourselves. But it, just as we wouldn't expect a man to come in dressed unprofessionally, and what would we think of him, we need to maintain our own standards of professionalism as well.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And to encourage them to continue to take us seriously, and the judge and everyone else in the courtroom. I think so much, I mean, now it's just a matter of general, as you said, dressing for success. What do our clothes say about us? What does the way we manicure ourselves and take care of ourselves say about us, and what we say about who we are, how we respect ourselves, how we respect the case, how we respect the jury and the judge and everyone involved by what we wear. I mean, it just starts to speak volumes without saying a word.
Right, exactly.
Barry, are there things that you would say maybe on a more strategic or tactical level, strategies or tools that you've used or experienced that might make a difference? I'm just thinking, are there ways that you've done things or things you've implemented into your personal life or your professional life that have just made things a little easier, have made the path a little more graceful as you try to do the juggle?
There are times when you, now we use the computer, when the strategy is to turn it off, just to turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
And the strategy is to put your BlackBerry on vibrate, not at the
right.
loudest sound. That's certainly important for your personal existence. In terms of your professional life, if I had to give advice, it would be on the skills that you develop for oral advocacy. And again, here's a story. There was a woman at the Justice Department who was older than I and very seasoned, and she taught me a very valuable lesson. I used to talk very quickly and feel the necessity of responding immediately to a question from the court. And she taught me a very valuable lesson, which was that the court's not going to think badly of you if you get your thoughts together. And that applies in everything. If you allow yourself the moment to consider what you really want to say and try to string it together in a sentence, maybe even a paragraph, you really come across more professional, and ultimately I think you're more successful.
That's great advice, and I even noticed that you modeled it when I asked you that question, and it took a moment to pause and collect yourself rather than stuttering and stammering and feeling compelled to jump right in and answer. You just took a breath. I mean, and it's barely noticeable. I mean, I only notice it because of your answer, but I know what you were doing now that you did that. Just like, took that second that again, most people wouldn't even realize that you were doing, but it makes so much difference in creating an articulate and well-thought-out answer rather than using the verbal pauses and the stammering and the just delays. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Those happen. Of course they happen, but at least to collect ourselves and present ourselves, like you said, professionally or personally, in a way that really does justice to what we're trying to say and communicate.
Gives you a lot more gravitas.
It does. And it's hard to learn almost mentally, I think, to take the moment. You can almost stop yourself in the moment before you make the verbal pause if you're very conscientious about it. But it takes some practice.
Yes,
and yet it adds so much.
Yes, it takes practice, but it really is worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank Penny Blair. If I have no idea how to get in touch with her, even with our mini social networking, but I thank her for that advice.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just that one thing that somebody tells us that maybe in the moment we're not even incredible. Sometimes we're receptive, sometimes we're not, to the feedback, but it sticks with us and makes such a huge difference. One comment that someone made that helped us so much and made a big difference, and here you are now sharing that after all that time that you are sharing it with other women lawyers and making a difference for them.
I hope it does.
A ripple effect. Oh, I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will. Just those lessons that we can share with each other that we don't necessarily think about until someone says it out loud. It seems, oh, of course, that's obvious. Well, until you think about it and maybe even listen to yourself speak, you notice that you could take that moment or you could employ some of the strategies that you're suggesting that you haven't been utilizing. So thank you.
It really helps.
Yes, and in a bigger way, sometimes just taking that breath before and that pause before we do anything, make a decision, say something in the heat of the moment, that momentary break allows us to present whatever we want to say, whatever we want to do in a better way. And I think it crosses the spectrum in terms of the way we can utilize that tip, be it our oral advocacy or our just way of making decisions in our life, to step back for just a moment instead of feeling compelled to be right there with an answer or something to say immediately.
Right. I guess in a sense that, you know, it demonstrates your own, and here we go again, your
mm-hmm.
comfort in your own skin.
Mm-hmm. Right. That you're
okay.
And
you're right. It does apply in a larger sense. It's not just limited to oral advocacy.
Mm-hmm. So many of those things that we learn as lawyers that make us better lawyers, if we take, again, that step back and just think, maybe I could apply that in other places. Just as we bring our personal life into our professional, sometimes we can glean from the professional to the personal as well. That goes both ways. It's all wrapped up in one neat little package.
Right.
Oh, very well. Before we wrap up the call, I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to share with the women attorneys who are listening or reading your words. Is there anything, if you could pass on those last words of wisdom, what would they be?
Never give up.
Mm-hmm.
Be tenacious in your work and never settle. And I guess something really silly, proofread your brief once again.
It's true. I'm sure you've seen many of them over the years. It's so true. Again, something as simple as that. But I think it's that presentation, going back to that. You know, what do typos say
right.
about you and how much care you put into it?
I mean, I once had a partner make me cry because there was a typo.
Oh, my gosh. But yeah,
I learned a very valuable lesson.
Yes. Oh, Barry, thank you so much for your time today. It's been so wonderful getting to know you and learn from you and hear these great stories that you have from battle stories, like you said, from years ago when the profession of law looked very, very different for women than it does today. And everything you've learned from then until now, I appreciate you sharing it.
Well, I'm more than happy to do so, and I would welcome any calls from women lawyers who want some more advice as they have a problem. It's my pleasure to help.
With that, Barry, would you mind sharing your website and maybe your contact information so women who might have any questions for you or want to connect with you have the information they need to do that?
I'd be happy to. My website is bgoldsteinlaw.com.
Great. That's exact. And I'm going to just spell that really quickly. It's B. Goldstein. It's the letter B, G-O-L-D-S-T-E-I-N, law, L-A-W, .com. Is that correct?
Right. One word, B.
One
Goldstein
word.
Law.
Mm-hmm. Correct, B. Goldstein Law. Excellent. Well, Barry, thank you again for being here. I appreciate it so much.
It was my pleasure, and it was very good to meet you.
Oh, delightful to meet you as well. Well, with that, we will close out this conversation with Barry. I hope you've enjoyed a trip through the history of being a woman lawyer and being in the profession of law and seeing what it looked like and can compare it to what it looks like today and see such an evolution and yet knowing that there's still a ways to go in many areas. And I hope you can take something from Barry's experience and the wisdom that she shared and implement it into your life and your practice of law to improve both of them. So until next time, this is Kendra Brodeen of WomenLawyersOnline.com wishing you real success always and in all ways. Thank you for being here. Bye-bye.